October 12th on Prime Video.
This is WMNF in Tampa. Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Laura. I just want to mention a few things about the hurricane and hurricane relief before we start, and that is that monstrous hurricane that roared over the Florida Panhandle yesterday has caused almost uncountable damage. We still don't know how bad it is. We know that two people have died. We know that about 800,000 people right now are without electricity. Many people are unable to get back into their homes. It is a huge disaster. And we want to talk about some of the people that are trying to help out. The Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, you can email them locally at mutualaiddisasterrelief@gmail.com. They're gathering things to send to the victims of Hurricane Michael at 609 West Waters Avenue Church in Seminole Heights in Tampa. I hope that's right. 609 West Waters, or is it East Waters? I've got to check on that. But the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, you can email them at mutualaiddisasterrelief@gmail.com and ask them what they need and then hook up with them. They're in Seminole Heights, I know that for sure. And tomorrow they're going to take a truck up to the Florida Panhandle and distribute collected disaster relief aid. Also, the American Red Cross number, if you want to donate to them, their number is 1-800-HELP-NOW, 1-800-HELP-NOW. If you want to donate to the Salvation Army, their number is 1-800-SAL-ARMY, 1-800-SAL-ARMY. And if you want to get in touch with Volunteer Florida, they've activated their Florida Disaster Fund, volunteerflorida.org/donate. So those are some of the ways you can help out. As time goes on, we're going to find out more and more ways we can help the people of the Florida Panhandle and South Georgia. And I promise it's going to be on our website. You can go to our website right now and look at those organizations I just announced, facebook.com/WMNF News to find out more. 800,000 people without power in Florida and Georgia right now, two deaths, but I think we're going to find out a whole lot more. Well, this morning we've been trying to finish up the fund drive, and we've been hearing from a lot of people. The fund drive has been incredible. The food, Julie Scheid here at the station gets in touch with a lot of the best local restaurants and a lot of the best local chefs and cooks and make sure that's all coordinated. And the food at the fund drive has been incredible. There have been incredible people coming into WMNF for the past 7 days volunteering their time. Some people have come in for 30 and 40 hours to volunteer their time behind the scenes to make the fund drive work. We have our goal was $235,000. I think we're about at $217,000. I think that's where we are right now. And this will continue in a very low-key way for the next few days. People are still calling in. You can call in. I think for public affairs this morning, we need to hear from just one more people and we'll get that $3,000 goal. Thanks to Anonymous in Holmes Beach, they just made a $25 contribution. Thank you, Anonymous, for doing that. The phones have been lighting up all morning long. You can call in at 813-238-8001. Of course, you can make a contribution at any amount. If you want to make a $1,000 contribution, you can get that benefit pass and go to that super secret concert that we're not allowed to announce. A few minutes ago, we needed one more person to make a contribution to get reach the goal on public affairs. 813-238-8001 is our phone number. And there are more people that we want to thank. Lou Ratcliffe from Clearwater likes Democracy Now! And made a $5 a month increase in his Circle of Friends membership. He wants the Tom Petty CD download. Thanks, Lou. And thanks to Charlie Kilboy, who's a longtime listener of WMNF in St. Petersburg. Thank you, Charlie Kilboy, for a $150 contribution. Thanks for that $100 contribution to Anonymous in Plant City, Florida. And they like From a Woman's Point of View. And another donation came in for From a Woman's Point of View in Dunedin, Florida. $36 donation for From a Woman's Point of View. I think the Women's Show has reached its goal. One of those $100 donations was for the Trump Survival Kit, which includes interviews, speeches, all about President Trump, but pretty critical of President Trump, including Robert Baer, the former CIA analyst, is on there. Stephanie Kelton, The Economist, who just wrote a book called The Deficit Myth. She's on there. Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, has some thoughts about President Trump and the working class. Also, there's discussions about white supremacist violence on the upsurge since President Trump took office. How Sinclair Broadcasting and Trump are working in concert. That's one of the topics on this Trump survival kit. And a documentary, a 75-minute film talking about making America racist again. It's a video. It shows how racism is surging here in the U.S. and why is it happening. This is all part of that Trump survival kit. It's a thumb drive, and you can have it for a $100 contribution. Well, I'm Rob Loray, and today we're going to hear an interview with Jason Stanley, who's a Yale professor. He's written a new book about how fascism works. You may have heard him interviewed just a few minutes ago on Democracy Now! Jason is also the author of How Propaganda Works, and he was on earlier this week on our HD3 channel, The Source. He was on there with Mitch Jeserich, which is Mitch hosts a show called Letters in Politics, which is on every night at 6 o'clock, and Mitch will be on tonight at 6 p.m. on our HD3 channel, which is all news and talk. And Mitch interviewed Jason Stanley, and I was listening the other day for a few minutes, and I thought this is one of the most informative interviews about fascism I've ever heard. So let's listen to that now. This is the kind of program you can hear on our HD3 channel, The Source. If you want tips on how to listen to HD3, just email me, and I'll tell you a pretty simple way to listen to HD3. Just email me in the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. Well, let's listen into this interview that Mitch did with Jason Stanley, and afterwards we're going to open up the phone lines.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
In Germany, it was 5 to 6 years between Hitler's rise and election and seizure of power and Kristallnacht. So it takes a certain amount of time for the rhetoric to engender a kind of attitude that allows people to tolerate and participate in mass violence. Rwanda, I think it's 1990, 1991, when you first start to find the extreme rhetoric of cockroaches and rats. And so there appears in countries to be a period of several years where people get used to thinking of the targeted groups as being appropriate objects of mass violence.
A conversation on fascism as a tactic and the history of fascism in the United States. Our guest is Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley. He is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. He joins us next on Letters in Politics. Welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jeserich. I think many of us, in thinking about the history of fascism, think of Nazi Germany, Mussolini's Italy, and Franco's post-Civil War Spain. We think, perhaps, of fascism as an adjective. It's a fascist state or a fascist movement or even a fascist party. But our guest today, Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, argues that fascism is a tactic and that fascism exists even in a non-fascist state. And he points to the history of American racism as our own version of fascism. Jason Stanley is the author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And he now joins us via Skype. Jason Stanley, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
It's a pleasure to be on the program. Thank you, Mitch.
It's good to have you. What role does history play in fascism?
The role of history in fascism is critical. Fascism always starts out with a mythic history. Now, all nationalism starts out with a mythic imagined history. Benedict Anderson reminds us. All nationalism creates this myth of national identity. But not all nationalism creates the particular kind of myth of national identity one finds in fascist movements. In fascist movements, one finds the idea that the mythic national past was glorious, that in the mythic past, the people of the nation ruled over others. It was patriarchal. Men were men. Women were home raising the next generation. And so it's crucial for fascist movements to control the narrative of history, to create nostalgia for this past that never was, to create this feeling of great loss. That's how Orban came to power with Trianon, by talking about a greater Hungary when Hungary had so much more land.
They pointed to the fight against the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, because now that's what Orban is doing. Huh. Because Orban wants to position Hungary as the defender of Christian Europe. So now Orban presents an alternative history. He goes back even further to the time at which supposedly Hungary was the great defender of Christian Europe against the Muslim Ottoman Empire, which of course occludes the fact that the Ottoman Empire was in fact quite diverse and many other historical facts.
Also makes me think of Benito Mussolini and his feelings towards the ancient Roman Empire.
Absolutely. You always need to go back to this mythic past. You sort of create a vision of the mythic past to connect your movement with that. And then you promise to make the present like that again. You know, we find this creation of nostalgia. So fascism weaponizes certain emotions to control politics.
You write about this use of history and fascism with the United States concerning the Civil War. Tell me more about that.
Yes, well, we find that, you know, we're having these battles about monuments. Monuments were, of course, Civil War monuments were, of course, erected much later, way after the Civil War, at a time when it was important to create a certain myth about the past, to set the Jim Crow laws on an apparently firm foundation. So the idea being that the Civil War was fought to prevent Northern incursion and Black American corruption, which supposedly led to the end of Reconstruction. So there was this mythic past in the South that justified racial discrimination, and we have that repeatedly employed. You go throughout the South to, for instance, university campuses, and their odes to this this mythological struggle against the enemy. And when you hear people in the South, some people in the South speak about that struggle, they speak about it in ultra-nationalist terms. So they speak about it as, you know, well, this, even when they deny it's about slavery, they say it's about the homeland being invaded by foreigners, which is ultra-nationalism. It's kind of now it'd be anachronistic to call the Confederacy fascist, but for me, fascism is a sliding scale, and there are many elements of fascism in the Confederacy. There's the white nationalism, and there's this ultra-nationalism, of course, and sort of macho patriarchy.
Is there American fascism?
Oh, there's been American fascism as long as there's been European fascism. And, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is hard to distinguish ideologically from the European fascist movements, the 1920s. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan was harshly inveighing against labor unions. They were spreading the conspiracy theory that labor unions were run by Jews in order to foment race wars, which was very similar to what Hitler was saying in the 1920s already, even as early as the 1920s, about Senegalese troops in the Rhineland. He was saying the Jewish plot to get black men raping white German women. There's a huge overlap. Nancy McLean, in her Behind the Mask of Chivalry book from the 90s, documents the overlap in ideology between the 20s Ku Klux Klan and the National Socialists and the European fascist movements. And there was a tremendous amount of influence between the two. So the Hitler is deeply affected by the 1924 immigration, by American developments such as the 1924 Immigration Act. Hitler praises the 1924 Immigration Act in Mein Kampf, and in his second book, he says it helps create a national state of just the sort that he wants in Germany. So, Hitler, the Nuremberg laws, as my colleague Jim Whitman has shown in his book, Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg laws were based on the anti-miscegenation laws of the Jim Crow era. So, as I document in my book, the right to work laws that we now have as law of the land for public unions, they're based in this harsh anti-union rhetoric of the sort that you find in Mein Kampf.
How do you connect that? How do you connect the struggle today over this issue of quote-unquote right to work to what Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf?
Well, trade unions have always been the enemy of fascism. Trade unions connect us across material interests. So, a trade union, we all have aging parents. We all like weekends off. Trade unions connect us across our racial differences. Fascist ideology tries to connect us along our racial identity or our ethnic identity or our gender identity. So it needs to smash any dimension of identity that would make us feel like co-citizens because we share those interests. And that's what trade unions do. In a trade union, when it's functioning correctly, a woman and a man, an African-American and a white American, a Hispanic-American and a non-Hispanic-American are going to get together to plot how to get $2 an hour more. And that is a fundamental threat. And it's also a fundamental threat to an authoritarian leader, because a group of people mobilizing together for their own interests is a potential power source that can inveigh against the dictates of a party in power or a leader. And so labor unions, it's not for nothing that the poem in the Holocaust Museum by Martin Niemöller says, first they came for the socialists, and then they came for the trade unionists.
Multiculturalism is a threat to the fascists.
Absolutely, because fascism is based on an ultra-nationalism based primarily on ethnic identity. So multiculturalism, multi-ethnic democracy is anathema. And trade unions make us feel economically more secure. Economic insecurity is of aid to fascist government, because when we feel, in Hannah Arendt's words, atomized, then we feel fearful and we need some other identity. We need help from someone. And then we look to demagogues.
What did Hannah Arendt mean by atomized?
She meant that fascism thrives when individuals feel alone, when they feel unsupported and fearful, and they feel that there's nothing there, that they can't trust their fellow citizens, they can't trust institutions, and they're fearful about their economic well-being. She means they're individually atomized, and then they look for an artificial identity, a fake identity, like an ethnic identity, like race. Race is a construction. So the fascist leader offers people a fake identity, one that does not address their material needs or their material interests. And ultimately, the fascist leader offers themselves and loyalty to that leader as their ultimate identity.
I have covered some of these far-right groups, and one term I constantly hear, especially really is another term for multiculturalism, and that would be cultural Marxism. What does that mean?
Cultural Marxism has a long history. In one sense, it means Jewish.
It means Jewish.
So it's really important for people to read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to understand what's happening around them. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion says that Jews are behind Marxism, liberalism, capitalism, and feminism as well. You find that trope as well. Homosexuality, that Jews are behind these movements that seek equality for religious, ethnic, and sexual minorities. And cultural Marxism is used as a smear for movements that seek equality for minority groups. So you find people using cultural Marxism to talk about movements for gender equality, movements for gay rights, movements to recognize traditionally oppressed groups like African Americans. You find them tarred as cultural Marxists. And the idea is that it's kind of a conspiracy theory. The idea is what they're really seeking is to take power.
Where did these Protocols of the Elders of Zion come from?
Protocols of the Elders of Zion originated in a work of fiction in the mid-1850s, I believe. I talk about this in my detailed history in my book, How Fascism Works. And then they were taken up in 1905 by a St. Petersburg newspaper as a forgery. So initially, there was a discussion in I think it's Maurice Joly in his book. It was a discussion I forget exactly the two characters, but an evil person and a good person, and the evil person is talking about using liberalism as a way to gain power. And so, in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, this speech is put in the mouths of the so-called Elders of Zion, that is sort of prominent, sort of a shadowy conspiracy of global Jews. And the idea is they're going to spread liberalism. They're going to use the media. They're going to use education to spread liberalism, to spread freedom. And once you spread liberalism or Marxism to the dominant group, then they will willingly give up their power to you.
We are in conversation with Joseph Stanley. He is the Jacob Orosky Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, author of the book How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, I found that explanation of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion interesting. So thank you for doing that. I don't want to lose sight of the American Civil War, because you do write extensively about the American Civil War in this book, and in particular about W.E.B. Du Bois and his work called Black Reconstruction. Can you tell me about that?
There may be no more important book to read right now than Black Reconstruction in the American context. Black Reconstruction was published in 1935, at a time at which it was widely believed that the Reconstruction era, the era at which Black Americans in the South were freely allowed to vote, and indeed voted en masse and occupied many offices from the Senate to the House to state legislature. The Reconstruction era was brought to an end because of a myth of Black corruption. So this was widely taught in universities and schools. And even I'm 48 years old, and even I learned that Reconstruction came to an end because Black Americans ran corrupt governments in the South. Du Bois destroys this myth. And he shows that, in fact, Reconstruction ended because poor white laborers in the South and poor Black laborers were starting to band together in a labor movement. And this unified the interests of wealthy whites in the South and wealthy northern and white industrialists who were threatened by this labor movement. And in this book, in Black Reconstruction, which eventually, in the late 1960s, was finally recognized to be the true account of the end of Reconstruction, of what happened during Reconstruction. In this book, Du Bois simply gives us so many of the tools we need to understand fascism. He begins the book by saying, you know, in the beginning, God created this world and it was wonderful and everyone got along. And then he threw a Black man in the midst and fascism broke out. So he explicitly uses the term fascism for American racism. So he talks in the book about the psychological wages of whiteness, about which is the crucial thing to explain why poor whites will vote against their own material interests in accord with rich whites against people like against poor black Americans with whom they share material interests. So it's a big mystery. Why will poor whites vote to like slash their own health coverage? Why will poor whites vote to slash their own food stamps and government benefits when it hurts them? It hurts themselves. They're hurting themselves. And Du Bois explained this by this concept of the psychological wages of whiteness. Just being white gives you a kind of priceless dignity. And that's what the fascist politician does. The fascist politician makes this empty promise. They say, you have a special dignity that non-whites simply cannot have. And that dignity comes from being just from being white. And equality threatens that dignity. So equality will make you lose the psychological wages of whiteness. So not only does Du Bois there give us a lot of the tools we need to understand why people throw their own interests under the bus, their own material interests under the bus, he gives us a lot of the tools to understand fascism.
Jason Stanley, I want to quote from your book. Again, the book's called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And this is in your introduction. You say this, quote, in the cases of Nazi Germany, Rwanda, contemporary Myanmar, and the victims of ethnic cleansing were subjected to vicious rhetorical attacks by leaders in the press for months or years before the regime turned genocidal. Tell me more about that dynamic. The rhetoric was there before the governments actually acted.
So you find right now people saying, well, look, we're not encountering any genocide yet or mass violence. And that's not quite true, because as we see in the case of our criminal justice system, when we've been talking about super predators and thugs, which has fueled mass violence, mass state violence against black Americans. We have this recent history. But Trump's rhetoric very recently has not led people out onto the streets to attack immigrants. There's been a slight uptick in hate crimes, but it hasn't. 2 years after the campaign, we find dehumanizing attitudes increasing, but it's not like we're seeing large-scale mass violence against immigrants in the streets of the United States. But if you look at other countries, if you look at, say, what happened in Myanmar, it was actually 5 years from the time that mass violence started to when the ethnic cleansing began. In Germany, it was 6 years, but it was 5 to 6 years between Hitler's rise and election and seizure of power and Kristallnacht. So it takes a certain amount of time for the rhetoric to engender a kind of attitude that allows people to tolerate and participate in mass violence. Rwanda, I think it's 1990, 1991, when you first start to find the extreme rhetoric of cockroaches and rats. And so there appears in countries to be a period of several years where people get used to thinking of the targeted groups as being appropriate objects of mass violence. And right now we're seeing incredibly harsh rhetoric in the United States of the sort that we found in Rwanda before the genocide, of the sort that you find in the 1930s against German Jews, against Jews, directed against immigrant groups. And people are saying, well, it's just talk. And the fear is that if you read the literature, like Viktor Klemperer's Language of the Third Reich, for many years people said it was just talk. So it takes a certain amount of time and there's a preparatory phase and appears to take several years before people are tolerant of mass violence. You might look at the family separations as what Fintan O'Toole, the journalist, calls a trial balloon. It's seeing how Americans will deal with the complete brutalization of a group that is represented as hateful.
The normalization of it.
The normalization of it. That's right.
And you also write that fascist politics does not necessarily lead to an explicitly fascist state, but it is dangerous nonetheless. So you can have fascist politics without having a fascist state.
That's right. Right now, I don't think anyone could say that we have a fascist state. And fascist states differ wildly from each other. So it's not, my book is not a generalization. It's about fascist states. It's not a book about what a fascist state is. It's about fascist rhetoric and fascist ideology. There are certain tactics, I identify 10 tactics, that are used to seize power, to divide populations against each other, and to create a fanatical group of loyal supporters. And these, the particular tactics I focus on, I call fascist tactics because they're based on ethnic identity and ultranationalism, patriarchy, and the different things I talk about in the book. So these are mechanisms to seize power. And they could result in, they have resulted historically in very different outcomes. I mean, Orban is not now doing mass killings or genocide. You don't find that in other countries that are susceptible right now to fascist politics. Nevertheless, fascist politics is in and of itself dangerous. In the first instance, it dehumanizes segments of the population. Fascism always requires a target. It requires an outgroup that is impure, that are rape threats, that are criminals, that are lawless, against which the people, us, need to be protected. So it always lays the groundwork for mass violence against that group. And given our own history of mass incarceration and present of mass incarceration and harsh rhetoric against Black Americans, we're especially prone to that. And now we're seeing that directed against immigrants, against the media, against liberals, against cultural Marxists, feminists. So it has this dehumanizing element. And the second thing, as I argue in my book, is there's a temptation for politicians to make the rhetoric into reality. So the president, when he ran, claimed that there was an epidemic of violence sweeping through the, quote, inner cities, unquote. Now, this was wildly in contrast to reality. I mean, there's been a slight uptick in violence, but we're still at historically low crime rates. So what happens, but it's going to be conducive to such politics to create crime. Because the more crime there is, the more panic you can run on the next election. And so, you know, it's going to be like, this is what, you know, Hitler talked about this when he said, people doubt that the Jews are lazy and diseased. Well, we're going to send millions of Jews across borders, diseased, hungry, in need of support, and then they'll see what we mean. So there's this tendency to make the rhetoric true. And that's a danger over and above the dehumanization.
Jason Stanley is our guest. He is the Jacob Borowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. He's the author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, that's really interesting to think about, because I guess when we think of fascism, we think of Nazi Germany, we think of World War II, we also obviously think of Italy during this period of time, we think of the Holocaust, and major, huge global events. And maybe we have this expectation to think about fascism, for fascism to exist, you have to have that kind of major global event. But that's not so.
No, that's not. I mean, well, my focus is on fascist politics, and to have fascist politics be successful, what you need to do is destroy your democratic ethos. You need to destroy the ethos that makes people want to live in a multi-ethnic state. You need to destroy the ethos that makes people feel loyalty towards a multi-party democracy. Arendt talks about the the dangers of the sentiment of party over parties. When people start thinking, well, I don't care about a multi-party democracy. I just want my party to rule all the levers, have all the levers of power. So when people start to lose the democratic ethos, when they start to lose their grip on reality and replace it with power and loyalty, then you need to worry. Because a liberal democratic ethos takes a long time to create. It took us in the United States a long time to create an ethos where we had a public culture of anti-racism. And that seems to be very quickly.
Well, you write about the perceived war on corruption or even draining the swamp. This also has. And, you know, corruption, obviously, and stopping corruption is an important thing. But you write fascists use corruption and a war on corruption, anti-corruption campaigns for their own ends.
When fascist politics takes hold, things mean their opposite. The news becomes the fake news. The news becomes the Lügenpresse, and anti-corruption means corruption. Corruption doesn't mean what it ordinarily does. What I discovered, and I was very surprised by this, is that all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. The Ku Klux Klan achieved power in the 1920s by running against corruption. Look at Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin constantly runs anti-corruption campaigns. By some accounts, he's the richest man in the world, enriching himself off of state treasures. I discovered it in the literature on National Socialism, that the National Socialists ran anti-corruption campaigns, but yet stole and looted Jewish property, art, and lives. So Du Bois, as I talk about in the book, I mean, we've already discovered this in Black Reconstruction. Reconstruction was supposed to have ended because of corruption. And Du Bois said, what does corruption there mean? What corruption there means is that it was corrupt that Black Americans were allowed to vote at all. So corruption for the fascist means that a corruption of the traditional order. As I said earlier in the interview, fascism weaponizes the emotion, the feeling of purity. So corruption means impurity. So when the fascist runs an fascist politician runs an anti-corruption campaign, they're running. What they're saying is that the traditional order has been subverted. People who are not members of the chosen nation have too much power, are allowed in positions of power. As Kate Mann argues in her book Down Girl, we saw this dialectic unfold in the 2016 election when Donald Trump, of all people, was able to run an anti-corruption campaign against Hillary Clinton. And as Kate Mann rightly says, what happened was he was representing women ruling as president as a corruption of the traditional order.
Jason Stanley is the Jacob Borowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. And he is the author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, I found this very interesting, and I thank you greatly for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mitch. Terrific conversation.
Well, that was Mitch Jezrich, who hosts a show on community radio in Berkeley, California, KPFA. He was interviewing Jason Stanley, the Yale professor, on his new book, How Fascism Works. And I thought I'd play that for you because I was listening the other day on our HD3 channel and thought, wow, that was fascinating. So if you're you can, please make a contribution to WMNF. The fund drive is officially over. I think we're about $17,000 away from reaching the final goal. We'll have kind of a low-key fund drive for the next few days trying to raise that last $17,000. We are in a few minutes. I don't know if our phones are hooked up, whether or not we can do a call-in. That may be a little bit impossible, but I want to thank a few people. Thanks to Tom Farner from Tampa. He says this is Tom's support for HD3 and The Source. That's where that program that we just listened to came from. The interview with Jason Stanley was carried earlier this week on our HD3 channel, and Mitch Jezrich's show is on every evening at 6 o'clock. So if you're interested in thoughtful news and talk, you might check out our HD3 channel, The Source. Tom in Tampa just made a $100 contribution to keep it on the air. Tom, thank you. Tammy Vaughn from Parrish, thanks for making that $100 contribution, getting one of the WMNF t-shirts. Thanks, Tammy. That's great. And also thanks to Charles Harper from St. Petersburg. Charles, thank you very much. He's also getting a WMNF t-shirt for his $88.50 donation. You can still call us up at 813-238-8001 and make a contribution and help us reach that overall goal of $235,000. I think we raised about $217,000 or $218,000, somewhere in there, during the seven-day drive. So we're still trying to finish off the drive. And I don't know if we can take phone calls. This will be interesting because I would like to open up the phones and talk about fascism. Do you think that that we're on the way to fascism? And what would be the targeted groups? Who do you think President Trump is targeting? Do you think that President Trump has made any stand against the far right in this country? Has he taken any stand? What do you think? I don't know if these phones are going to work. 813-239-9663. Just want to remind you, too, that there are now about 800,000 people without electricity in northern Florida and southeast Georgia as Hurricane Michael, now a tropical storm Michael, makes its way to the northeast, is going to head out to sea. But certainly it's going to impact those areas of North Carolina and South Carolina again that were already impacted by the previous hurricane. And the folks in North Florida are seeing tremendous damage as they try to return to their property. There are several ways to help. You can there's a local mutual aid disaster relief volunteer group that's gathering material to send to drive up in a truck to North Florida. And you can contact them at mutualaiddisasterrelief@gmail.com. And also the American Red Cross number is 1-800-HELP-NOW. And the Salvation Army number is 1-800-SAL-ARMY. 1-800-SAL-ARMY. 800,000 people without power, two deaths so far, a devastating hurricane in North Florida. And as WMNF gets back to normal, we're going to try to figure out some ways that you can help. There were four hospitals that were closed because of the destruction of Hurricane Michael in the Florida Panhandle, and that puts a tremendous toll on healthcare up there. So we're going to try to figure out ways to help people and give continuing announcements as the as we hear more and more about the best ways to help people in North Florida. If you want to comment about the interview that Mitch Jezrich did about fascism, you can also email us in the studio. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. That's dj@wmnf.org. And maybe we can start a conversation that way. I don't know if we're going to be able to open up the phones this early. I don't think we've really switched from marathon mode back to normal mode. But you can still call in with your contribution. And I know for a fact that you can call in at 813-238-8001 and still make a contribution right now. If you found that interview about fascism interesting, and if you found that you learned a lot, I certainly did when I listened to that interview. And I think it's a warning to all of us. Certainly, I think people that listen to WMNF don't want this country to descend into fascism. Well, how does it take hold? That was one of the questions answered in that interview, and I thought that interview with Jason Stanley was incredible. So if you want to support interviews like that, which you can hear a lot of on our HD3 channel, and sometimes you can hear on our main channel, please make a contribution at 813-238-8001. That's 813-238-8001. We still have the Trump Survival Kit audio collection for a $100 donation. It features interviews with people who are skeptical of President Trump, Stephanie Kelton, the economist, Robert Baer, the former CIA analyst, Thomas Frank, the journalist. There's a whole program on why white supremacist violence is on the upsurge. There's a whole program on media, why groups like Sinclair Broadcasting are aiding Trump, what they hope to gain by that. Increased militarism under Trump. There's an exclusive report, the inside story of Trump University, a whole hour program about the people who were ripped off by Trump University, a story that has really fallen off charts. It's not really talked about much anymore. And there's a bonus feature, Making America Racist Again. It's a 75-minute video exploring how the U.S. has elected Donald Trump and traces the history of racism, bigotry, and scapegoating in the country back to the early days of the founding of the country. So that's all part of the Trump Survival Kit collection. It's a thumb drive that includes audio and video. And again, you can call us at 813-238-8001 and get that Trump Survival Kit for a $100 contribution. I know more people are calling in. Some people may have missed the fund drive. If you were out of town during the fund drive and you weren't able to make a contribution, the fund drive just ended officially at 11 o'clock this morning. We still have to make up about $17,000. We'll have a low-key fund drive. Won't be doing a lot of talking. But we're trying to make up that deficit. Some shows were very successful during the last 7 days. Some shows didn't reach their goal. I think that public affairs was kind of like hit and miss. About half the public affairs shows reached their goal, about half didn't. So we'd like to hear from you. If you like the midday shows, please call up and make a contribution at 813-238-8001. Just a note, too, that Shelley Reback is going to be in the next hour, and she's going to be hosting the Midpoint program. And then at 1 o'clock today, we'll have executive session. And tomorrow on Midpoint, I just got this email in from one of the candidates who's running for office. Her name is Kimberly Clark. I think that's right. And Kim O'Connor. And she's going to be on Dan Ruth's show tomorrow. She was targeted by Dan. Dan wrote a really funny column about her alleged smoking marijuana when she was in a hotel room on official business a few weeks ago. She says that she was not smoking marijuana. Anyway, so Dan wrote a column because the reports from the hotel owners and the property managers were that the room reeked of marijuana smoke. Kim Connor is a Green Party candidate for Hillsborough County Commission, and she's going to be on Daniel Ruth's show tomorrow to respond to what she says are the inaccuracies in his column about her in the Tampa Bay Times. So that should be interesting. And Justin Garcia on our staff writes this, the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. He says tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., they are filling up their box truck at Waters Avenue Church. This is at 609 West Waters Avenue in Tampa. And they're going to leave right after the event at 4 o'clock. If no one is there when someone stops by, you can drop off supplies under the overhang, but someone should be there. So, Justin, thanks for that. Justin is also a volunteer with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. So they are gathering tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., filling up their box truck on Waters Avenue at the Waters Avenue Church. This is at 609 West Waters Avenue. This is a homegrown volunteer mutual aid society, sort of like the mutual aid societies that were here in Ybor City in the 1930s. And they're going to drive the truck up to the panhandle and deliver their relief. And Justin, if you're listening, tell us what you need. You know, I'm assuming that people need water, but there may be other things that people have that they could send to people. Just imagine if your house was destroyed or if the roof was torn off, what would you need? Would you need a tarp? Would you need building supplies? Would you need hammers and nails? But I imagine the number one thing to do is get some water up to those people because it's something that we always need. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663, email address djwmnf.org. Now, 352 area code, Anonymous writes this, the Trump University story isn't being talked about anymore because it's a nothing burger. There's no there there, writes 352. I think there was something there. People who were... I think take it in by the President Trump's appearance. You know, he surrounded himself with this idea that he was wealthy and successful. From that New York Times story, we know that when he was 3 years old, he was already wealthy because he was the de facto landlord of his father's part of his father's business empire. His father gave him a lot of money, about $400 million. Over the course of Donald's lifetime so far. And it's hard to mess up, You can, if you inherit a lot of money from your parents, that amount of money, it's hard to mess that up. Even if you and I, who have no financial investment training, were to just go to the Vanguard S&P 500 listing and invest there, we would make a killing. We would have made a killing, you know, going back to the beginning days of Vanguard. If we had just taken $200 million and invested in there, we would be fabulously wealthy. Is President Trump worth $10 billion, as he claims? I don't think so. Forbes came out with its list last week, and he was probably worth $3 billion, not the $10 billion that he's been claiming. But that New York Times article a few weeks ago, which we spent a lot of time hearing about on Democracy Now! Last week, was really an eye-opener. Because how could a three-year-old be a landlord of millions of dollars of property? How is that even allowed in this country? It's just amazing. He couldn't possibly act as a landlord. Justin writes back regarding the mutual aid disaster relief that's leaving from Tampa tomorrow. This is what they need: water, canned food, Pedialyte, baby supplies. Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of diapers that people need. Hygiene products, first aid kits, tarps, building supplies, gas or gas cans. So again, if you're going to go to the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Collection site at 609 West Waters Avenue at the West Waters Avenue Church in Seminole Heights, this is what they need: water, canned food, Pedialyte, baby supplies. I imagine diapers are in very short supply. Hygiene products, first aid kits, tarps, building supplies, gas cans. That's what they need. And they're leaving tomorrow at 4 o'clock for the Panhandle. So if you can get over there, that's what they need. So I don't think that we're going to be able to take any phone calls. Bill Grace is back there answering phones, but I don't see any phones being lit up at 813-239-9663. I'm Rob Lori, just chatting away here as we move up to the NPR News. We do have 5 minutes, though. If you want to send in an email, you can send in an email to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org. And we could discuss what you send to us. Lots of interesting stories in the news today besides the hurricane. And we could, I wish we could talk about that. The stock market had a big plunge yesterday, 3.15%. It's down again today for those of you that care about the stock market. The stock market way down for the second day. Usually one of the leading economic indicators. Now it's down about 98 points. There are some interesting stories that are on the newspapers and on the websites right now. David Jolly, the former congressman from St. Petersburg, a Republican who took Bill Young's place and then defeated Alex Sink in a race for Congress. David Jolly now has officially left the Republican Party. He did that the other night on the Bill Maher program. And the group Next Gen America, which is headed by the billionaire Tom Steyer, claims that it's registered 50,000 Floridians to vote ahead of the 2018 elections. They've sent out crews across the state to try to register voters. New poll shows that Andrew Gillum and Rick Scott hold slight leads in new polls. Democrat Andrew Gillum has a 3-point lead over Republican Ron DeSantis in Florida's race for governor, and Republican Rick Scott leads Democrat Bill Nelson by 1.5 points in the race for U.S. Senate. You can find that story on the Tampa Bay Times. And again, you can email us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org if you want to comment about anything that I'm saying. In South Florida, the postal unions were protesting against a Trump proposal to privatize mail service. This happened in Viera, Florida, just in the last few days. And I'll tell you about some other stories, too. There are claims in the Orlando Sentinel today that an historical number of Puerto Ricans have been registered to vote. The registration deadline was earlier this year, and Puerto Rican groups are claiming that 40,000 newly registered Puerto Ricans are now on the Florida ballots. So that should be interesting. We'll see if that pans out. We'll see if those people actually vote. And Let me see some of the other stories that we could talk about. Al Hoffman, the big Republican donor, has decided to shun Florida Republicans over their stance on guns this year. Al Hoffman being one of the biggest contributors to the Florida Republicans over the last three decades. So we could talk about that. You can email us here at dj@wmnf.org. And the Democrats are claiming that they have registered a huge number of voters before the November 6th election. We'll see if that's true. Well, if you want to comment about anything that you've heard here, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the news and then Midpoint with Shelley Reback. 12. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg.